Welcome to episode 23 of Practical Defense, an interview with David Baker. Welcome back to another episode of Practical Defense. I'm your host, Alex Haddix. Before we get into our interview this week, I need to ask for your assistance. I've joined the Wizard Media Network to help promote the show, and they'd like to know more about you. So it'd really help me out if you could complete a quick listener survey. It's a short list of questions that should take less than 2 minutes to complete, and the link is on my site at alexhaddix.com/podcast. That's alexhaddix.com/podcast. There's a big red button at the top of the page, and it would really help me out, and I greatly appreciate it. I'd also like to thank those folks who've already completed the survey. I received a bunch of emails from people letting me know that they had taken the time to help me out. Thanks again. All right, on with the show. This week we have a fantastic interview with David Baker. Also, for those that have been with us for a while might remember our interview with Graham Baker back in episode 8. Just to be clear, there is no relation between Graham and Dave. They just happen to share the last name. However, there is a relation between Dave and me. Dave is my father-in-law. Yep, I married his daughter. Now, Dave is a former Los Angeles County deputy and a Vietnam veteran, and I chatted with him about his experiences in law enforcement via Skype since he's spending some time in Arkansas right now. The background noise that you hear is from heavy rain since they're getting some really heavy storms out there, so we had to stop a few times during the recording to let the thunder pass. So if you hear any odd cuts, that's probably what it's from. Now on to the interview with David Baker. So with us today, we have Dave Baker. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
You're welcome.
Now you, before you got into the police, you were actually in the military, is that right?
Yeah, I was in the Navy for 4 years, from 1964 to 1968.
And during that time, you spent time overseas, actually. I think you were a Vietnam vet, is that right?
Right. I was overseas almost all 4 years. I didn't have a real exciting job in the Navy. I was a postal clerk. I had a lot of interesting assignments overseas. And in Vietnam, I had some real interesting assignments to deliver mail to remote detachments in some far-reaching places via helicopter.
Yeah, I remember you telling me stories that you actually flew in helicopters in the Hueys back then, actually from the main cities out to the fire bases.
Right, I was stationed in Da Nang. I was with the Seabees, assigned to a battalion 128, and they were deployed on 6 to 8 month tours, and then they would go home for 6 months and then come back. So I was with them on one of those, and my job was to twice or three times a week deliver mail to our remote detachments that were doing construction in remote places. And that was done by grabbing a mail bag, going across the street to a Marine helicopter base, and an Air Force pilot and a chopper would meet me there, and we'd fly up to these places and deliver the mail. So it's just him and me, and there were some interesting experiences doing that.
I can imagine.
I can remember many times where it was just him and me. We had a window gun, and a lot of times we didn't actually have to go down and get into battle, but we did have to land and retrieve wounded people.
So as you're en route, they actually pulled you off that to go pick up people?
Yeah, because we were monitoring the radio, and you know, if there was a bunch of injured soldiers, whatever they might be, they would ask us to go pick them up. So we would pick them up, and then we'd just go right back to the Navy hospital in Da Nang, drop them off, and then go back and do what our original job was to deliver mail. So we were usually gone all day because we did get diverted a few times, and sometimes we'd fly into, I can remember going into Dong Ha, which was north of Vietnam, north of Da Nang, and having to, hold off because it was too hot to land. So, a lot of times we'd, we'd either wait or we'd go somewhere else and finish that up and then go back, or if it was too hot, we wouldn't go at all.
Well, and after all that, when you came back to the States after your 4 years, you went into law enforcement. What drew you to law enforcement?
Well, I've always, you know, growing up, I always thought it was an interesting thing. You know, it's like playing cops and robbers when you're a little kid, and that, you know, it's good to be on the good guy's side. I needed a job. You know, I was just starting a family. I had a small son who was less than a year old, and I was working for a office equipment company, you know, servicing machines and not making enough to live on. So I saw an ad for the L.A. County Sheriff on TV, and I went and applied.
How long were you with the L.A. County Sheriff's Office?
7 years.
Wow, 7 years. From, what was that, 60, you said 68 to?
69. July 1st, actually July 2nd of 1969 until summer of 76.
Wow. So I don't know how many years it's been, but you still remember the exact dates, huh?
Yeah, well, because, you know, my oldest daughter was born on July 1st, and I remember going and dropping my wife off at the county hospital and then going to the academy. And then on my way back, you know, stopping to visit with her, because she was in the hospital for, you know, 3 or 4 days. So, you know, it was just a matter of necessity. I wanted a job, so I couldn't, you know, delay my starting of the academy. So did what you had to do.
Yeah, I guess so. So they start you off, well, I guess with the sheriffs, a lot of times they start you off in the prison system. But for you, you said that was a little bit different for you.
Yeah, most of the time they do, because, you know, the sheriff's responsible for the jail system in the county, which, you know, is where all the people that get arrested in the cities go to when they're convicted. So I can remember at Central Jail, which it's now changed, but back then it was very large, and, you know, there were several thousand inmates. So they send the new deputies there, and it kind of smooths them up and takes the rough edges, because, you know, when you finish the academy, you think you're Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, you know. So you got to kick some of that off and get back to reality. And the jail's a good place to do that. So in my case, I went to the jail system, but I didn't work in the jail. It was actually called the Sheriff's Transportation Bureau. And what we did is we transported prisoners to wherever they needed to go. The biggest job was, you know, taking all the prisoners out to the different courthouses in the county every morning and then bringing them back in the evening, you know, or bringing additional people back as it happened. And then in the evening shifts, they would take people out to the sheriff's on a ranch out at Kestack, you know, or up at a medical facility out in Antelope Valley. And that's what that thing did. Now, I was there a real short period of time. Normally, I would have been there maybe 2 or 3 years, just like the deputies that went into the jail system. But there was a deputy in Altadena that wanted to go back to the Transportation Bureau. He'd been assigned there years before. And so we did a body swap, is what they called it. And I traded, you know, assignments with them. So I went to Altadena Station and worked in patrol, and he went back to the Transportation Bureau. So I was fortunate that I got out of that early. Fortunate in terms of, you know, getting out and doing what you really wanted to do when you went on the department. So, yeah, I was lucky.
So you say you're lucky, so you enjoyed it then?
Yeah, I enjoyed every minute of the department. I mean, there were some difficult times, but, you know, the learning experience I had during that 7 years has helped me sense in business and dealing with people and things like that.
Business sense, like you're dealing with criminals when you're talking about business?
Well, now, you know, the 7 years of dealing with people who lie to you, you know. Now, I'm saying of the criminal element I dealt with, there are many, many good people that I came in contact with, but generally the people that you had to, you know, take some action with, they would, you know, they wouldn't always be, you know, honest with you for good reason. And you learned how to read that. You know, you learned when someone wasn't really telling you the truth. And years later in business meetings and negotiations, that experience I had as a deputy was very helpful.
So what was your day-to-day job like?
Well, I was a patrol deputy, so that was, you know, I might explain the Sheriff's Department structure a little bit. And the Sheriff's Department in Los Angeles County is responsible for the law enforcement jobs or duties in unincorporated areas of the county and in contract cities where the city has no department, but they contract with the Sheriff's Department for those services. So, you know, where the city of Los Angeles, their police are responsible for those duties in the city of Los Angeles. Well, sheriffs very much like that, but just in the unincorporated areas and contract cities. So my day-to-day job, most of the time I was in patrol, I was worked 7 at night till 4 in the morning, which was, you know, probably the busiest shift. And typically we were the only car out on that shift because Altadena Station in the 70s wasn't, you know, a large station. You know, we might have had 5 or 6 cars out in this unincorporated area each night, and I was in the one that worked 7 to 4. And we worked with another officer. You had a partner in those days at night. You didn't work alone at night, and now it's not that way. But so we would go to work. We'd be briefed, you know, with what was happening in the area. We'd grab our gear, throw it in the trunk, and hit the streets. And the, you know, early 70s was the heyday of marijuana and that kind of stuff. So the majority of our arrests were drug related, and especially on that shift. And you know, my partner and I were making about 300 arrests a month.
Holy cow!
During those years. So, and then we'd be in court to testify on those cases. So we worked 4 days on, 2 days off, which meant you got a weekend every 6 weeks. And just because you were off didn't mean you didn't have to go to court. So even in your off time, in our case, the courts were open during our off time. So, you know, we'd go to work at 7, get off at 4. We'd have reports to write. That would take a couple hours. And then have to be in court at 8 o'clock. So we'd just stay there nearby the station, you know, have breakfast, go to court, be in court all day, even if you didn't testify. A lot of times you'd just be sitting in the officer's waiting room, taking a nap or reading the paper or something. And then at 4 or 5 o'clock, not enough time to go home, so just go back to the station, take a quick shower, put your uniform back on, and back out on the street. So it was a busy period.
Yeah, no kidding.
So once we got out on the streets, and we just, you know, we patrolled like, you know, you would expect a policeman in a patrol car to do, and we responded to lots of different calls, the whole gamut. You just, if you think of a crime, we've probably done it or been to it.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of those. 300 arrests a month is a huge number. How was it dealing with criminals? Now, you saw different types of criminals. You probably saw the casual criminal, like the guy out to buy his first joint, all the way up to the hardened drug dealer. What was it like dealing with criminals all day long? Did it have any sort of effect on you?
I'm sure it did. In fact, I know it did. That, you know, I became kind of hardened. You know, over the years that I did that, I know that I kind of separated myself from people who weren't policemen. or in law enforcement. And because, you know, I dealt with all the criminal element that, you know, like you said, from the smallest crime to the most serious crime, from the criminal that was easy to deal with to the one that just, you know, scared the heck out of you just to talk to him. And, you know, and then on the other end is the victim. You know, the victim went from someone who, you know, lost something, you know, or to the most serious where, you know, someone's loved one was murdered or killed, you know, senselessly. And so that surely changes someone, you know, changes the way they deal with people and their family and things like that. So, you know, sometimes you need to take a break from that.
But it sounded like you didn't even have time to go home, much less take a break.
Well, no, you know, I didn't work that shift the whole 7 years I was on the department. It was for about 2.5 years, 3 years maybe, that I worked that shift. But, you know, during the other times, I did have, you know, a fair amount of time at home. But, you know, even so, even not, you know, not being as busy, you still tend to want to hang out with those people that you feel most comfortable with. And that, and in a lot of ways, that's not a good thing.
Now, was that because you felt you could trust them, that they were not criminals, and that's because they were cops?
Oh, I don't think that was it so much, because I'm sure I could trust, you know, a lot of non-law enforcement citizens, but it's because they're the ones you had something in common with, and policemen have a tendency to only want to talk about that. So they hang out together, and when they're speaking cop talk, they're understood, and they understand what people are saying, where other people may not. And sometimes other people may not take it the way that you meant it.
Now, with the victims, a lot of the times the police are accused of being cold and not caring. Is that because you were saying that a lot of times what you said as a cop could be misinterpreted? Was it because that you didn't believe them, or that you couldn't get emotionally attached?
Well, no, I don't think it was either reason, because you surely could get emotionally attached. I've been emotionally attached with several victims that I came in contact with, and in terms of, I could really feel their pain, and I think I understood what they were going through. But a lot of times you'd see a victim who was just a, you know, like a chronic complainer, and there was nothing wrong. You know, they call you 4 or 5 times a day, and, you know, and it could be as simple as, you know, their neighbor's dog is barking, or, you know, someone's parked, you know, more than, you know, 18 inches away from the curb, and all kinds of silly things. And those kind of people, yeah, you become a little cold too, and a little hardened. But, you know, the ones who call, and you get there and you find that this young boy has been beaten by his father and he's got cuts all over his back, you know, you're not cold to that kind of a victim.
How was it dealing with domestic disputes? From what I understand, it can be really difficult because say, for example, the woman's been beaten by her husband and she finally calls the cops on them. Now, from what I understand, the procedure is to send like 3 different cars. So they have one group of men or one group of police officers on the man, and then you have another group for the woman.
Yeah, that's true. We always we didn't send more than one car, but other cars always respond as backup just for that very reason. Those are the most unpredictable calls to go on, and I can give you a few instances of that. I can remember going on a call. I was going as a backup unit. A deputy was stopped on the street by a man who said his sister was being beaten up by her husband. This was in Altadena, and that he was threatening to kill her. He called us, and the deputy called us and asked us to back him up. And we got there, and there was another car that heard, and he came as well. So there were 6 deputies there. And as we approached the house, the man stepped at the door and fired 2 rounds from his revolver, I think it was at the time, at us.
Was this the husband or the guy who made the call?
The husband. the brother was, you know, back by the cars. So the deputy who was handling the call knelt down and fired 3 rounds back and hit the guy in the head and killed him. And 2 rounds were found later in some of the most oddball places in the house because they're going to ricochet all over the place. And then when we went inside, you know, the woman was very thankful that we just saved her life. But before we left, she was talking about suing us for killing her husband, you know. So she'd gone from thankful that she was still alive to we just murdered her husband.
And what was that time frame? Was it like 20 minutes, an hour?
Yeah, maybe 20 minutes to a half hour.
And, wow.
You know, we were there a lot longer than that because the, you know, the support detectives, homicide and investigative shooting detectives have to come out and do a lot of things. But, you know, it was that was a case in many times where you go and, you know, protect someone from being beat up by a spouse and then before you left, they were beating you up. So, you know.
Did they ever go into the psychology of that?
Well, not with us, but, you know, I can think, you know, why that was, you know. And when people are, you know, in a relationship and there's a just kind of a natural loyalty protection instinct that's in people that, you know, will try and protect them and stick up for them even when they're wrong, even when they're wrong against you. So, you know, I can understand why it happens. I just, that's what makes that kind of a call for a policeman so dangerous and so unpredictable.
Do you think this guy was trying to commit suicide by cop?
No, I think he was actually trying to kill us. That's the way it seemed. You know, or here's, you know, when people are in that mode, they're not, you know, they're not thinking the way they normally would. You know, a lot of stuff going on probably there before we got there that we have no way of knowing about. You know, what was going through his mind? Why was he doing it? It was clear when we got there that he didn't want us there. You know, not just from the gunshots. That was one indicator, I'm sure. But, you know, just the way he carried himself, the way he looked at us, you know, and that. When we first got there, we didn't see the gun when he came to the door. And then he raised his arm and we saw the gun and he got those couple rounds off before we knew what was going on. Fortunately, he wasn't a very good shot. And Jim, who was handling it, was a good shot and took care of it.
Now, back in those days, did you guys wear vests as part of your normal outfit?
No, we didn't have vests. This was the, you know, early 70s, and not just... We didn't even have them for emergency purposes. I think the SWAT team or in the sheriff's department, it's called the Special Enforcement Bureau, I think they may have had them, but we didn't. You know, we're just wearing, you know, a cotton shirt. That was it.
Oof. Now, do you think this guy was he intoxicated or on drugs?
Well, I don't remember exactly. He was a little bit intense, so he could have been on some kind of, you know, upper, but I don't know.
How often did drugs play a part in the arrests that you made? Other than, you know, that it's a drug bust, but when something else was happening and you were called to the scene, how often were drugs involved?
Oh, almost. I'd say for crimes against people, you know, like theft and assaults and things like that, I'd say the majority of the time back in those days, they were all committed because of the, not necessarily because they were on drugs at the time, however that was a lot of times it was, but because of the need to get money to buy drugs. That was a lot, most of the reasons for those types of crimes, burglaries, robberies, you know, assaults to rob and things like that.
When you're approaching a suspect, what's going through your mind?
Be careful. That's the first thing. You know, I guess you never know. You know, even in the simplest thing, like a traffic stop, you don't know where that person has just come from or what he might be running from. You know, I remember once stopping a car. Let me give you some background. A few months before, we had had a call, and it was a robbery at a bank. And so I was working day shift then, and they described the car as a white Valiant with one of those wheels on the back of the trunk. You know, it wasn't a wheel, but just like a wheel cover type thing. And
yeah,
and that it was bright orange. And I always thought, man, that was a stupid car to use to commit a bank robbery. You know, it's like putting a sign on there. Here I am. But they never caught him. Months later, when I was working in the evening on this other shift, I stopped the car. It was a white Valiant. And walked up, and there were two guys inside. They looked, you know, like they were a little bit nervous. As I got their driver's license, and I was walking back, and I looked at that wheel, and I saw some orange paint under this white paint. It turned out they were the bank robbers, and they had guns in the car. And fortunately, when I went back to the car, we didn't make a big fuss about that because we didn't want them to get excited and start shooting. You know, we didn't know at the time whether they had guns, but we called for backup. And when the backup got there, it was pretty clear they weren't going to put up a fight. But so you never know when you stop someone; they could be anybody.
So how did you delay them? I mean, what did you say?
Just told them that I was going to check their driving record, you know, like run them for warrants and stuff like that, you know. And, you know, had they had warrants, I'm sure they would have probably made an attempt to flee. But, you know, it didn't take long for the deputies to get there when I told them on the phone why. You know, I told them, you know, I had 211 suspects, you know, stopped and needed backup. It wasn't long before the whole station was there.
So 211 is called for a bank robbery?
Yes. In California.
Now, one time you told me that you actually witnessed a robbery in progress. I guess you and your partner were having lunch or something and somebody robbed a store right across the street from you.
Well, this is a very unusual thing. It was in the Sheriff's Academy. When you're in the academy, part of your training is that, you know, once or twice a week you'll go to one of the stations in the county and ride along with a seasoned deputy, and that's part of your training. So my very first ride as a deputy, where I went out and was, you know, being a real cop, so to speak, was in Norwalk. We had stopped for coffee at a little coffee at a donut shop. Of course, that's where it would be, you know. And across the street was a liquor store, and we were sitting there, and next thing I saw was a guy running out shooting behind him, and then the owner running out after him shooting at him. We were across the street and chased him down.
Yeah, what? Okay, corral going on.
Yeah, and the seasoned deputy told me, he said that, you know, he'd been on the department for 14, 15 years, and he'd never, ever seen that before. Never, ever seen an armed robbery in progress like that. And that I probably would never, ever see one again. And I didn't.
Yeah, but on your first time out while you're still in the academy, it's enough to make you want to quit.
Actually, it didn't. It made it more exciting for me. I mean, I guess if it had turned out differently, you know, where I got injured or something, yeah, I might want to quit right then and there. But, you know, we actually caught the guy, and you know, is when you're involved in that kind of thing and you return to the station, you have the suspect in custody, you know, it's almost like hero status, you know, because everybody's congratulating you on a job well done, and, you know, and telling you how, you know, how that never, ever happens to them. And, you know, You know, how come it happened to a cadet in the academy on his first night out, that kind of stuff. So, you know, it was pretty exciting.
So take me through this. How did you catch an armed robber who's running down the street shooting at the clerk who's also chasing him and shooting? How do you handle that?
The clerk gave up. You know, after a few seconds, he stopped and went back to his store. But the deputy, my partner, the seasoned deputy, said, "Let's get the car," and we chased him down. And he apparently, the deputy knew the area real well, knew right where the guy was probably going to go, and he came running right up on us, and we had our guns pointed at him, and he gave up.
He didn't shoot?
Nope.
Smart man.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't need to. And, you know, because he didn't. I mean, he knew that he was caught, you know, and it probably wasn't worth it to him to risk his life, you know, for a bag of a few dollars I can't even remember how much he got, but I know it wasn't much. It was enough to make the owner chase him, I guess, but, you know. So it turned out okay.
Now, I realize this is back in the 70s, and times are different now in the 2000s. But what did anything happen to the clerk who was armed and then running down the street? Was there any sort of prosecution against him?
No, not at all. You know, he was protecting his property, and he was, you know, in fear of his life. And, you know, back in those days, you weren't under the same scrutiny that you are today. You know, if you were a store owner or property owner and someone was threatening that and your life, then that was justified the way he acted. We were concerned, you know, and we were glad that he, you know, curtailed his pursuit, so to speak, and that, because it would have been a little more difficult to apprehend the person with a store owner, you know, in view. So, because then it would have been a whole lot riskier. Don't know how it would have turned out.
Because the store owner may have gotten involved?
Involved or in the way. You know, if the store owner had been nearby, maybe the suspect would have tried to, you know, take him hostage or who knows what.
Now, actual physical confrontation, the actual handling of a suspect, how does that work when you got somebody and they're not necessarily complying, but you can't... So back then, you didn't have tasers or mace or anything like that. You had your pistol and you had your fists. So what did you do when it came to physical... You know, you actually had to take the guy down and restrain him.
Well, we actually had two other devices. We had our baton.
Oh, right.
And back in those days, it was just a straight stick, you know. It didn't have the handle on it like they do today. And it wasn't made of the hard plastic back then. It was wood. And then we also had a sap.
Oh, you had saps?
Yeah. They were issued to us.
Okay, so for the people out there that don't know what a sap is a strip of leather that's got lead shot or sand in the middle of it. It makes a very, very heavy, blunt weight, and they're really painful and can knock people out very easily. They're illegal to carry.
Yeah. And they're not very long, maybe a foot.
Yeah, but that is a weapon.
And I don't know about today, but in those days, the uniforms, the trousers that were issued had sap pockets. So there were a special little pocket just below your right rear pocket where a sap would fit. And that's where you carried it.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah. So we had those. Well, anyway, to get back to the question, you know, usually we didn't use anything but our hands and arms, you know, to subdue someone. We used, you know, different holds, you know, the bringing the arm behind the back and applying pressure upward and that kind of thing was usually worked most of the time if you could do that. If it was someone who was much stronger than you or someone who was real big, either big in weight and stockiness, and sometimes it would be difficult to get an arm behind his back, and then it might take more than one deputy if they were really fighting. It just depended on how hard they fought. Sometimes it was, you know, a knockdown fight where you had to get them on the ground, and you know, because you couldn't do things like pull your gun out and say, get down, you know, because, you know, if they were unarmed, what are you going to do? If they say, no, I'm not, you know, you're not going to shoot them. So having a gun out would be probably the most foolish thing to do. So you had to approach every case separately. And you know, if you were afraid that you couldn't subdue them, you probably wouldn't try to without backup. If you had to, regardless, then you would just do the best you could. I always, in every case, if I could, tried to talk them into subduing before I'd use force. Now, some other deputies, you know, who maybe still had the Wyatt Earp stuff on them, wouldn't. But I always felt it best to try and make them believe that the best thing for them at that time was to cooperate. And it worked most of the time. Occasionally it didn't, and you'd have to use force. But, you know, if I didn't have to, I didn't want to. I can remember many times where I've had to use severe force, you know, to stop someone from doing something. And he usually ended up hurt or in the hospital.
Now, what sort of combatives training did you have?
Well, it wasn't as sophisticated as it is today, but we did, you know, practice all the time in the academy, you know, usually one deputy practicing with another, where one was a suspect, one was the officer, and different kinds of holds and restraint methods, you know, both with your hands and arms and with the baton. The baton was a good instrument for getting people to do things, not where you just knock them over the head, but, you know, where you could, you know, I used to use it. If I'd have someone handcuffed and he wouldn't cooperate, I'd just put the baton between his wrists and, you know, use it as a lever and just kind of more like a leash to lead him around where I wanted him to go. And that seemed to work pretty good. And then I can remember throwing my baton at someone's feet to knock them down quite a few times. We used to practice that a lot. So, because back in those days, it was different. You know, if we had tasers or things like that, rubber bullets, we didn't have those. So, you know, there's a lot of things we couldn't do then that they can do now.
As far as tools available to you, non-lethal force?
Right. I think back then it was just, you know, your own, you know, body and then the baton sap.
Yeah, I think they call it less than lethal these days. Rather than non-lethal.
Right. Yeah.
Now, speaking of use of force, I believe you once told me you were on duty during the East LA riots back in 69?
Yes, I was.
That had to have been an experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. It was I was working the day shift in Altadena. I was actually working inside on the disc. I was the what they called the watch deputy, where, you know, I'd make sure that the people in the field, you know, were supported, and when they brought people in and got booked, that I'd assist with that, and, you know, just inside kind of work. Every deputy had to do it once in a while, and I remember on the radio I heard the call go out. They had, in the sheriff's department, we had three calls: 997, 998, and 999, and I think, if I remember right, 997 was an officer involved in a shooting. 998 was that he was requesting backup from everybody in his area. And 999 was he was requesting backup from everybody on the planet. So, you know.
That's everything's gone to hell in a handbasket. Come save
my right.
butt.
Yeah, he needs, you know, all different law enforcement agencies would respond to something like that. So there was, can't remember the exact dates, but there was some celebration going on in East LA, and it started over a deputy trying to make an arrest for being drunk in public, which is probably not the best thing to do. But it escalated, and I heard on the radio this 999 call go out. And my watch sergeant said, you know, you and another, his other deputy's name was Tom. He said, you and Tom, take that cadet who just walked in the station, one of those ride-along cadets from the academy.
Oh, no.
And he said, go down to East L.A., you know, and go code 3. So we grabbed an extra shotgun and got the car and went down, and this poor cadet in the back seat was just, you know, so what's going to happen? What do you want me to do? You know, he didn't know what to do because this was serious stuff. And Tom was driving, and I was passenger in the front. And we got down on Whittier Boulevard, and there were buildings on fire, and there were people all over the place. And we saw this group of guys running at us. And at first we couldn't figure out what they were carrying, but when they got close, we saw it was a railroad tie.
Wow.
And they were going to launch it at us like a spear, which they did. And I told the deputy in the back, the cadet, I said, you said, get down and get over, you know, and that railroad tie came right through the windshield in between Tom and me over the front seat backrest, hit the back seat, and bounced back onto the hood of the car.
Wow.
And then they were still coming at us, so we grabbed the shotguns and bailed out, ran into a store and took cover. And they burned our car up. And I remember it blew up right out in there in front of us. And we used the telephone inside that store to get help, because we didn't have portable radios in those days. You know, we didn't have walkie-talkies or personal radios. The radio in the car was our only way of communicating.
Oh, wow. And also, just to go back, the car actually blew up like Die Hard style? It actually exploded?
Yeah, they set it on fire. And, you know, when the fire got hot enough and it hit the gas tank, it was, you know, an explosion. And it lifted it up, and I remember seeing it upside down or on its side or something like that. It was just all burnt, just a shell of a thing. So, you know, we got the backup, and they came and bailed us out. So that was our first experience of the riots when we first got there. And later we were assigned to groups of deputies, you know, and we were on Whittier Boulevard, and we'd responded to a call of a man with a rifle in a bar, and he was taking pot shots at police as they drove by. And so we went there, and this is a kind of a famous thing that happened because it was really on the news in those days. But a sergeant from Montrose Station, who was down there for the same reason I was, he took a tear gas gun, looked like a little, you know, grenade launcher type thing, and we had these flight right tear gas projectiles. They looked like a little missile. And he fired it into the bar after we'd repeatedly asked the people to come out. And unfortunately, it hit a man in the head and went through his head and killed him. And that turned out to be a prominent Latino newscaster.
Oh. And so the newscaster was hiding inside the bar commentating on the events, and he got caught in the crossfire.
Well, that's what they tried to say. I think he was in there, you know, antagonizing the whole situation. Like, you know, you don't have to give up and that kind of stuff. And so, anyway, he was dead, and the people did come out, but you can imagine the kind of, you know, situation it created afterwards. And I think the sergeant had to move two or three times in months afterwards because of threats and things like that. So that was that incident.
So how long did the riots go on for? I mean, I remember the Rodney King riots they had here. It lasted several days.
So did these, because they assigned us, we were working 12 on and 12 off, and there were six deputies to a car, you know, which can be crowded. you know, especially you get a couple of big deputies in a car. These were like 68 Plymouth Belvederes is what we were driving in those days. And it would get crowded, but we'd go out on patrol for 12 hours and drive around Whittier Boulevard and make sure that their people weren't looting. All the stores were closed and all the windows were broken out and that. And I can remember stopping at this bank, Bank of America, and there was a car in the parking lot, which we thought looked a little suspicious. And we walked up, and it turned out to be a security guard for the bank. And it was this elderly African-American guy, and he was sleeping in his car, and he had a big revolver laying on the seat next to him. So we woke him up, got him out, and I looked at his gun, and you could see where he had painted it black. Apparently the bluing had worn off of it in the past. It was old. So he just painted it with a brush black, and the cylinder was frozen, and you know, you couldn't, I'm not even sure it had bullets in it, but, you know, that was his form of protection. So, you know, he was just really wasn't protecting anything in that mode.
So your job was actually to arrest or quell the revolt. You were just kind of trying to keep the protect the property until it kind of fizzled out?
Yeah, but there were many, many arrests in the process of doing that because people, mostly for looting, because after the initial cause of the riot and the people just, you know, running around burning stuff stopped, then it was people saying this is a good chance to get a free TV set or something. So, you know, keeping them from doing that. And then just being on your guard because, you know, the tensions are high during that period. And, you know, the desire for a lot of those people to want to injure law enforcement, you know, is high. So, and, you know, I remember a newsman, a news photographer, they were following us around, him and the newscaster and the news photographer. And the photographer was always making remarks to us like we were being too brutal or using too much force. And we told him, you need to get back, you know, you're going to get hurt, you know, and we have to do what we have to do when these people come at us and that. And he just kept, you know, chipping away at us. And next thing we knew, someone had tossed a brick and it hit him in the head. And knocked him down, knocked his camera out of his hands and stuff like that. And so we called an ambulance for him, paramedics came and took him away. And about 2 or 3 days later, he was back with bandage around his head. But, you know, he was now very friendly and on our side, you know. You know, and he was saying, go get him, you know, you're doing a good job, and stuff like that. So
knocked some sense into him, literally.
I made a believer out of him. It did.
Well, before we go for this time, you said you actually had another story for us, one that being prepared and having practice and thought ahead actually saved your life.
I do. It was in the summer. It was in Altadena. It was in an area that was intense because it was mostly ghetto type area, and people were not real friendly to the police. And I was on patrol with my partner. His name was Fred, and we had stopped a car that they were not driving right, and they were full of people, and they're all moving around in the car, and we thought there's something wrong. And so we just stopped them to check them out. And unfortunately, where we stopped them was in front of a liquor store.
Why was that unfortunate?
Well, because, you know, hot summer night in an area like that, there's a lot of people there. People going in and out of the liquor store may be under the influence of something. You know, if something goes wrong, you know, it's more likely those kind of people would get involved. In this case, that turned out to be exactly the case. So, you know, that was one of the things that we probably should have thought about before we stopped them, was maybe had them pull forward or keep going and stop them somewhere else. But we didn't. So I was driving. My partner was the what we called the bookman, the person who did all the reports that night, and he was a passenger. And And we stopped this car, and I got out. And always when I stopped and there was going to be an interrogation or something away from the car, I would take the microphone or the radio and hang it out the driver's window so that if I had to use it, I didn't have to open the door or lean in through the window to get it, that it would be right there. You know, I just grab it with my hand and use it.
And that's again because you didn't have the mobile radios.
No. So, and you know, it was on a long spiral cord, so you know, it hung out there pretty good. And so we stopped the car and we got the people out. Well, it turned out two of the girls we thought were under the influence of heroin, probably, because they had tracks on their arms, and so we decided to arrest them. And we told them, and we handcuffed them, but after we did, they started to fight with us. Well, Fred was on one side of the car, and I was on the other side, so I had one of these females, and Fred had the other, and the one that Fred had fell to the ground. You know, I looked over my shoulder where he was, and I saw him lean over to pick her up, and then someone come running out of the crowd, someone very large, and kicked Fred right in the face just like a football.
Oh.
And I could see him flying through the air. His helmet had come off. He was flying through the air. His eyes were rolled back in his head, and his, you know, I could see the whites of his eyes. I couldn't see, you know, any other part of his eyes, and blood just gushing out of his face. And he hit the ground, and I thought he was dead. So I was standing right next to the car door, and I grabbed that radio, and I called for help. You know, had that radio not been there, I would have had to open the door, lean inside, get the radio. But after I called for help, some people came over, and they were starting to try and take Fred's weapon from him, and I withdrew my weapon and I ordered him to step back, which they did, fortunately. And the crowd was starting to gather now. Everybody was around this liquor store, was, you know, wanting to see what was going on. And I got grabbed from behind by someone, had me in kind of a chokehold. I couldn't see him, but I told myself, I'm not letting these people take control, and I'll do whatever I have to do to get away from them. So I didn't feel like I could just, you know, shoot him. I had my gun out. So I just took my gun, and this was a 38 revolver, Smith & Wesson, 4-inch and 38 special, and I just took it around, and I threw it back and hit him in the face with it. And I remember later that the hammer caught him on the nose and just basically ripped his nose off. And he let go, of course, after that. And
yeah.
And that gave me an opportunity to get to the radio again. And then I put out a little more emergent call. So, you know, I think I actually used the 998 call. And then I went over to where Fred was, and I stayed by him and just kind of, you know, kept an eye on what was going on until the backup got there, and I kept an eye on the suspect who had kicked him, because he was starting to flee. He was getting in a car. About that time, another unit arrived, and I pointed that car out to him, and then I lifted Fred up and put him in my car and took him to the hospital, because I felt I could get him there quicker than waiting for an ambulance.
So if they had actually touched his weapon, his service weapon, were you authorized to shoot them at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if they'd have taken it out, I would have probably fired. You know, because at that point, you know, that's the time when you have to make a decision, you know, because the time they have it in their hands, or the time for them to fire at you or at someone else, you know, that's not very long. If you're sitting around thinking, well, is this the right time to shoot? Let me think, should I or shouldn't I? What'd they teach me in the academy? By then you might be dead.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think I was prepared to shoot. I'm just, you know, fortunate that I didn't have to. So, but it was scary.
Oh, yeah. Now, what happened to the guy that grabbed you from behind?
He got arrested.
Yeah. He was easy to track because he was the one with the messed up face.
he wasn't going anywhere, you know, because I don't think he had anywhere to go. And, you know, even though it seemed like hours that this all took place, it was less than 35 seconds. So when I listened to it on the radio, my two calls for help were, maybe 30 seconds apart. So,
wow. So you actually got to listen to the recording of the incident afterwards.
Yeah.
When you were actually listening to it, how did you feel?
I felt kind of funny. I mean, I was glad that I would. The thing that I remember the most is putting my radio, the microphone, outside the car. And I think when I think about that incident, even now, over all these years, whenever I think about that night, I think about what would have happened if I hadn't done that. You know, because I believe that that was what saved us. Because I would have had to turn my back to the people in order to get it out and ask for help and put myself at risk and Fred at more risk. So, you know, probably the best thing that happened in that was what happened to the guy who kicked Fred. That was, you know, he was caught and he was taken to court and we went to court and he'd been in prison before and he was on parole. And when he got to the Superior Court after his preliminary hearing, it was the trial time, and they offered him a deal where if he pled guilty to a certain number of things, he had several things charged with, and that they would give him a year in the county jail. And I wasn't happy about that because I thought it was too late, but he refused. He was such a bad guy, you know, that he says, no, I'm not going to do that. So he went to trial, and he was found guilty on two counts of assault with a deadly weapon, I think it was, because he may not have intended to kill anybody, but on a police officer, which even made it more serious, and then rescuing, which in the California Penal Code means, you know, like taking a prisoner away from an officer. That's called rescuing. And he was charged with that. It's a felony. And then...
Because of the women that you had handcuffed that were on drugs?
Yeah. They got away.
Oh, they got away. They ran off with your cuffs, huh?
Yeah. So, you know, they got them eventually. But, I mean, at that moment, they got away. And it turned out that the guy who kicked Fred was a cousin of one of the girls. But, and anyway... Because he didn't take the deal when it came time to sentence them, the judge sentenced him to the maximum on every count to run consecutively.
Ow.
So he's probably still there.
Oh, boy.
You know, that happened in 1974. So, you know, 26 plus 8, 30 some years. You know, he's probably still there.
Well, those are some great stories, Dave. I really appreciate the time that you spent with us.
You're quite welcome.
And I'd love to have you on again sometime.
Yeah, be more than happy to.
Thanks again for being on the show, Dave. I'm certain that we'll have you on again in the future. And in fact, if you have any questions for Dave, send them in and I'll collect them for the next time that we have him on the show. Write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Well, that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions and commentary, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe.
Kevin MacLeod.